Now today, on The Long View, Issa Kam interviews Mark Archambault of the National River Watershed Association. Folks, take it away.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Issa.
The cost of gasoline has only begun to climb. Future increases are assured. Today, we continue our energy series by focusing on our limited petroleum-based oil supply and what we can do to overcome the problem and create a sustainable society without this unnecessary dependence. There are a variety of contributors to the problem, not least of which is that we are addicted to oil. But as long as we don't resort to burning other fossil fuels, like coal, it may actually be good news for the planet. We'll hear more about the topic today when our guest, Mark Archambault, the Smart Growth Circuit Rider at the Nashua River Watershed Association, shares his expertise. And typical on the show, we always have these really long names. A professional proponent of sustainable development, Mark is knowledgeable about its many facets, not least of which are the topics of steady state economy, or no growth, and so-called peak oil. He'll address the current oil scenario and suggest steps we can take to move away from reliance on fossil fuels. Before we begin the interview, just a reminder to please visit WUML-longview.org, WUML-longview.org, to learn more about today's topic and many other related topics. Also, please note that Mark, along with other sustainability gurus, will be presenting at a free two-day event titled Oil Depletion, Smart Growth, and Sustainable Communities. That's going to be May 23rd and 24th. That's a Tuesday and Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. That's at the Groton Senior Center in West Groton. And I'll put some information on the website. The term peak oil is bandied about in the news media quite a bit these days, but its meaning isn't self-explanatory. In short, the term peak oil refers to the peak in global petroleum oil production. The fact is, America has already experienced its peak oil production capacity in 1971. That's it, folks. It's all downhill from here as long as we continue to rely on fossil fuels. Mark pointed me to an informational website. It's energybulletin.net. It provides this information about peak oil, and I'm paraphrasing. Oil is a finite, non-renewable resource. Oil companies have extracted the easier-to-reach, cheap oil first, of course. The oil pump first was on land near the surface. It's called light and sweet oil, therefore it's easy to refine into gasoline. The remaining oil, sometimes offshore, far from markets that use it, in smaller fields or of lesser quality, takes ever more money and energy to extract and refine. Under these conditions, the rate of extraction inevitably drops. Furthermore, all oil fields eventually reach a point where they become economically and energetically no longer viable. If it takes the energy of a barrel of oil to extract a barrel of oil, then further extraction is pointless, or shall I say ridiculous. Thank you for joining us today, Mark, again. You have a history of sustainable development efforts under your belt now. Please share some of your personal background that led to your interest in sustainable development, but especially as it relates to the natural environment.
Thank you, Issa. Well, first of all, I grew up in rural southeastern Connecticut in a relatively new subdivision that was adjacent to a lake. And from an early age, I get out of my canoe and went fishing and hiking, and I grew to love the environment down there. And I get to know the birds and the animals, and I think that really instilled in me at an early age the importance of environmental protection and the environment to us. Mm-hmm. And it also struck me, too, that there was really no relation between the subdivision that I was living in and the land around there. Though there was farmland in the town, there seemed to be a disconnect between how we lived in our little suburban, you know, subdivision and the surrounding landscape. And that struck me from an early age, and it's probably not until now that I really realized the implications of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and every kid should have that opportunity to hang out in a natural landscape like that. Well, tell us about your career path that led you to your current position.
Sure. When I was in college as an undergraduate, I had trouble initially picking a major. And one thing that's characteristic of me is I'm interested in just about everything. I love to read and sort of, you know, learn a little about a lot of things. And
yeah.
I discovered that planning or urban planning is a field that is sort of a generalist field. It's a field that tries to connect various elements into an integral whole. When planning for communities and towns and cities. And so I naturally sort of gravitated towards that, and after receiving my undergraduate degree in environmental design at UMass Amherst, I re-enrolled in the graduate program for planning. So that's how I became a planner.
Oh, neat. So you've been on a path. That's interesting. Now you've landed at that place with a very long name. I'm sorry.
Yes.
The Nashua River Watershed Association. How did peak oil become, specifically that component of sustainable development, understanding about the topic, how did that become important in your work now?
Well, first of all, I encountered the concept of peak oil. Maybe concept's not the right word, but the reality of peak oil and oil depletion on the Internet. And at first, I read a few articles there, and I even picked up a book called The Party is Over by Richard Heinberg, and that was very good, and it got me a little bit concerned, but I really didn't grasp the implications of this situation until I watched a really good documentary called The End of Suburbia, which came out in 2004,
mm-hmm.
And after watching that two or three times, it really sunk in what a serious crisis and challenge peak oil and fossil fuel depletion will be for our economy and way of life.
Interesting. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. We tend to think that, peak oil or oil depletion will just result in rising gas prices, that we'll just be paying more dollars to commute and get to work and that sort of thing. But the implications go far beyond that. Oil and natural gas are integral to the growth and sustainability of our economy. Also to food production. There's a scientist at Cornell University, David Pimentel, who has estimated that it takes, on average, about 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy to produce each calorie of food in the United States. That's because of the amount of pesticides and fertilizers and all these inputs that come from petrochemicals that go into food production.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the average food item in the United States travels about 1,400 miles from the point of origin to consumers.
Wow.
And we have to truck that, of course, across the country. You know, we get lettuce from California, oranges from Florida, and we even get, apples from New Zealand when we could very well grow them here. So, the globalized economy uses a lot of oil. And once the price of oil goes up enough, that will trickle down or actually that will sort of reverberate through the entire economy, and prices across the board will go up because just about everything we do depends on oil and natural gas.
Right, right. Well, since there's an obvious conflict of perspective where the depletion of oil is concerned, in greater society, can you share some of the arguments of the opposing side? What are they saying?
Yes. Well, that would be the cornucopians. There are some oil analysts, actually mostly economists, who believe that the peak is a far-off event. It could be something between the year 2020 and 2030 or so, that we don't really have to worry yet. There's a lot of oil left to discover. There's even a very small group of geologists who have this theory that oil is actually renewable. It's called the abiotic theory of oil production. And according to that theory, oil is just sort of oozing up from the center of the earth, and eventually it will just refill the oil fields that have been depleted. But a lot of recent studies and evidence indicate that the views of the cornucopians and these people are not correct. We're finding that the large oil fields in Saudi Arabia, in Mexico, and other countries are depleting faster than expected. Many petroleum geologists are now conceding that the peak of oil production could be actually sooner than later, that it may occur prior to the year 2010, just a few years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I understand that these very rapidly developing countries like, India, but especially China, they're using an amazing amount of oil very rapidly.
Yes.
In their effort to, you know, catch up, per se, with the United States.
Yes, that's true. And look at all the goods that we purchase from China. They need to use oil, natural gas, and coal in order to produce the electricity and, you know, the transportation to get those goods to the United States and to the entire world. So, yes, we tend to think of China as a country where everybody rides on a bicycle to get to work. But, indeed, car ownership is increasing much faster in China than any other country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how China and India develop has enormous implications for the peak oil situation.
Right, right. And global warming.
Yes.
Yes. Now, outside of the economists and the geologists, there are other naysayers and politicians and, mm-hmm. and probably people invested in, continuing to support the oil industry. I mean, how do I say this? The naysayers' motivations. Who owns what? How tied in, actually, do you believe, or maybe you can address this, but how tied is our federal government with the oil industry? I'm trying to suss out the motivations here.
Yes. Well, that's a big, certainly with the current administration, we have two oil men at the top of our government. And historically, and this is true for Democratic and Republican administrations, the oil industry has, because of its federal role, has received many subsidies. They get a lot of federal assistance,
mm-hmm.
and I think that underwrites the cost of oil. I recall that Lester Brown, who founded the World Watch Institute, said if we had to pay for all of the externalities and the costs that really go into a gallon of gasoline, the price now would be probably around $10 a gallon or so. So by subsidizing the oil industries, you know, it turns out that we're getting cheaper gasoline, and that has probably resulted in a delay in our addressing the situation by developing alternative energy sources, working towards sustainable development, et cetera.
Yeah.
When oil and natural gas are cheap, we tend to build new suburbs far from where people work. Gas, and also another important thing is the auto fuel efficiency has stayed about the same for the last 20 years, or it's even decreased. So I think, you know, the federal government has definitely a role to play here.
Right,
not been playing that role very well so far.
Yeah. Gosh, I hope we have an administration in the future that turns the tide.
Yes.
Yes. Why is the mainstream media preferring to downplay the peak oil issue and its potential effects?
Well, they're actually starting to catch up, and I think the recent rise in gas prices is catching their attention. And also, many of the experts on peak oil are giving presentations and symposiums, with increasing frequency.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the downside, why they tend to downplay it, is because there's really no good news. There's no plan B that has been bandied about. There was a study commissioned by the U.S. Energy Department by Robert Hirsch of Science Application International Corporation, and they asked him to look into what's needed to address this issue. And he said that in the best case, we have 20 years. If we had 20 years to address oil depletion, fossil fuel depletion, we could have a soft landing. We could make a relatively smooth transition to an economy based more on sustainable, renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
With a 10-year lead time, you know, it would be a bumpy ride. We'd probably have a severe recession in there somewhere, but we could eventually make it. If we wait until the peak actually occurs before we start mitigation efforts, it'll be very, very difficult indeed. And unfortunately, there are signs that, as I said, the peak could be very near.
Right, right. Oh boy, this is another topic on the long view that we could go into a good solid hour easily with this. Between you and I, as I watch our time go by rather quickly, are you aware of political candidates? And yes, I'm returning a bit to the government, the component of this. Are you aware of political candidates that have a grip on the issues at hand who are ready to embrace renewable energy?
Yes, actually. And one of them is a very conservative Republican congressman from Maryland, Roscoe Bartlett. He started the Congressional Peak Oil Caucus with Randy Udall, who's a Democrat from Colorado. And together, they're trying to educate the Congress on this issue. So, yes, the government is, you know, or at least people in Congress, are starting to pay attention. Locally, I really can't address that, except, you know, one of the reasons we're putting on this workshop is to help educate our local and state officials to this problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in terms of models, can you describe the latest and most efficacious model of local sustainable development?
Mm-hmm.
Are there examples of say, you know, a larger community in the United States or Massachusetts or maybe in the greater Lowell region?
The ones that I'm aware of that have done the most work in this regard are Willits, California, not very local, but if you type that into a Google search, you'll see that they have a whole plan for developing a sustainability program for their town.
Mm-hmm.
There's also Tompkins County, New York, which is where Ithaca is, and they have several intentional communities there, and that county is actually planning for what I call a power down, which is to reduce demand to meet declining supply. And I think that's what we're going to have to do across the board in the United States in the next few years.
Right, right. Well, I think you have some specific examples. And just before we go to those to sort of finish out the segment, you mentioned that you prefer the concept of steady state economy, which is no growth economy, over smart growth. I think people would be really interested to know the difference. And why is the former, or the steady-state economy, more sustainable for us?
I think that's because, you know, we live on a finite planet, and infinite growth in a finite planet is probably not possible. And you can think of energy, too, is money, essentially. Money is based on the amount of energy that's available to do work.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be hard for the economy to keep growing in the conventional sense that economists think of it once we start down this, the peak oil depletion, once we start sliding down that curve. So I think we will need to, in order to have as high a quality of life as possible, develop a more steady state economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I joke that, you know, the Nobel Prize, anybody wants a Nobel Prize in economics, develop a steady state economic model that's consistent with the Democratic Republic. And good luck. You know, I think you would deserve the Nobel Prize if you can develop that. But I think that's where we need to go.
Well, I think before we finish up with the main conversation here, provide us with a few concrete examples of what our sustainable community would look like. I'll let you elaborate on
that. First of all, we will need to relocalize. Globalization will be reversed. That might be one good thing that comes out of,
mm-hmm.
out of this situation. We will need to grow more food locally, both on farmland and perhaps even within cities, on city plots or, you know, people having little flower gardens outside their window. We'll also need to manufacture things more locally. What people can do personally is they can use a car as little as possible for their next car purchase. Perhaps they can purchase a hybrid or something that gets, you know, really good fuel economy. They can carpool. These are all things that, you know, don't take a lot of effort that may actually help us in the initial years to meet the decreasing supply. Also, what would be good for people to do is to increase the efficiency of their homes. Essentially, there was a study that showed that if people had proper windows, we could actually save 1 million barrels a day in the United States out of the 22 million barrels a day that we're using if they had a more efficient windows and insulation in their homes.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yes.
That's amazing. Well, thank you for your terrific information and for your good work, Mark. I'm going to put the information about the event on the website at wuml-longview.org. And just make a plug here, too, for planning when we make our trips to do our errands or shopping, you know, all of our little trips, taking our kids this way and that way, that we need to actually spend a couple minutes, you know, planning a list of places that we're going to hit all on the same trip instead of one at a time. And this should make a big deal. And I've been talking a lot with my friends about that, especially those with kids.
Excellent.
Usually you're shooting out one, you know, one kid at a time in this direction and that direction.
Yeah.
That's another local helpful thing that we can do.
Right. And that's what I'm working on, too, in this workshop is to try to educate them as to what we can do in land use practices to develop more compactly, to have walkable communities, to develop more businesses in our downtowns, revitalize those small towns so that people don't feel they need to drive 30, 40 miles for entertainment or for some, you know, shopping item.
You know, this Pico thing could be good news. I really do think so. It might bring our communities together. We might actually get to know our neighbors and have shorter work days because our commutes are reduced. And there's some good news in these high prices. Thanks again, Mark. I think that we're going to be cut off soon.
Thank you, Ethan.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.